I changed slightly the sequence in which I would be talking to you about the relationship between art and the church. I was going to show you first the architecture of the church's history, and then show you the architecture now and some of the recent developments in church architecture, and then I was going to show you the art of the church's history and then art now. And I changed that primarily because I thought it would help your memories if, when I showed you the church's architecture, the following session could show you what went on in relationship to the church's architecture, rather than skipping a whole session. A lot of the stuff that we'll be looking at this morning is definitely related to the buildings, the monuments and things that we saw yesterday. And for those of you that were here yesterday, then it will help to realize that and make those connections. I am not a historian in the strict sense of the word. I love it, and I kind of wallow around in it, and much of my own work is historically oriented, but I'm a practicing artist. I see personally no more sense in history for history's sake than I do in art for art's sake. And so when I deal with art and in history, it's with the intention of trying to learn something for our time, to try and draw some good conclusions. As some of you may have realized last night, when I get started in the subject, I tend to get diarrhea of the mouth. My my discussion format generally turns into a lecture one, and that's too bad. A lot of people had questions, and I didn't make allowances for them. And so these people asked my wife. Liz came to me today with all kinds of interesting questions. You don't have to ask my wife. If I don't leave enough time, you can corner me as I'm walking around, and we can talk about it. Liz is a physical therapist. She probably won't be able to help you too much with this. She helps me with her physical therapy and being an artist, but I think as far as art history, if you ask her a question, she'll just simply ask me, and you'll get your answer second hand. But one of the questions was brought up by a guy who can't be here right now because he's on the work crew, and Jim Spica was kind of upset last night with the dumb guys at Pisa who did all of that crazy stuff, spending people's money building marble balustrades and staircases only to have a door painted on the wall at the end of that little episode. And he thought, you know, there are perfectly well-meaning righteous people who have given money to the fabric of the church only to have some clown for an artist or an architect do that really stupid thing. And he said he didn't think that was a bit funny. And that's what I got from Liz this morning. Liz says Jim Spica doesn't think that he's a bit funny because he thinks that people got ripped off down there, and he didn't want to ask me anyway that particular question because he knew I'd have an answer right back at him, and he wanted to wait until he could really phrase that question so that I have to stop and think about it for a while. Well, I do have an answer for that. The idea that what we've got here is an artist-client relationship or an architect-client relationship is really not true. We don't have the same thing in these times as we have now. We're kind of right. You know, you try and set history into the mindset of what's going on now. So you imagine the building committee of Pisa sitting around and paying this guy money, and he takes the money and does something really dumb with it, you know, like putting a window where it doesn't belong, or fiddling around with window space kind of thing. It wasn't that at all. As a matter of fact, you don't really have that architect client, master builder client kind of thing happening until much later in the Middle Ages, in the Gothic Ages, where you had the master builder and you had the development of the guild. The development of the guild saw to it that you had a kind of format of excellence, and that if anybody wanted any work, they would go to the guild, and the guild would assign a particular person to that job, and the guild would in fact guarantee that you got, you know, your money's worth, and that when it was done, it would stand there for a long time. It would be a well-done piece. Well, that's why I say, that's another one of the reasons why I say that the Gothic Age is not really the age of faith. The Romanesque Age, you want to do this thing, you jolly well better go and do it yourself. So, you know, these people are hauling bricks and stones to the cathedral, and all of a sudden one of the quarry men who's been working in the quarry finds a whole new vein of pink marble, and it was all white and green up to that time, and the guys still keep hauling the stuff out of the quarries, and the side of the cathedral changes color. You know, there was no master builder who said, the format of this building will be green and white. Period. Now, you come across a vein of pink, Charlie, hold it for the next cathedral, because we can't have pink in here. This is going to look like Christmas candy. You know, so the archbishop is just going to be terribly upset, you know, if we don't have some semblance of order. Order was the Gothic motif. Everything. I mean, I think the master builder must have had the Old Testament dictum over his drawing table. Let everything be done decently and in order. Order was a theology for the Gothic Age, but not for the Romanesque. Spontaneity was the order of the Romanesque people. It was sort of like, if you feel it, do it. Now, the only difference was, and we're going to get into that, the only difference about what got the order for the Romanesque was really how they felt. They felt good. I mean, really, the whole age was kind of like, I see it like a field of mushrooms.
That's horrible.
That's a terrible way to talk about these nice people. But like spring or like soft, mushy earth, with things scooting all over it, you know, just running helter-skelter, little critters and flitting things, and then all of a sudden, in this field of spring mosses, some little... And except the only difference would be that every mushroom was different. It was a different variety. So you had a what do you call them, morel over here with its big like that, and over here you had one of them little buttonholes, and you know, all of these were different kinds of things. One reason why they were different is people just didn't. They divided themselves into little territories. All of Europe was divided into these little territories, yet you even had little languages going on inside of these little... France divided into 27 little territories, some of whom we still refer to them by their provincial names, but no, you got Burgundy, Normandy, Languedoc, you know, all these little, and each one of them was kind of like a big walled area, and they all spoke in their own special language. Artistically, visually, they all said something very unique. And when it came time to build, everybody got together and started building. And when it fell down, they put it back up. And they said, I wonder why it fell down. Well, because our groin vault wasn't ribbed, probably, Harry. Let's try ribbing the groin vault the next time. And the next time they ribbed the groin vault, and it stood up there. And the Gothics came along and said, Charlie and Harry got a ribbed groin vault, and it seems to work. Let's push it a little. And that became the Gothic. So, the guys who did the artwork, who designed the cathedrals, who built all of them, and it's the same in all of these things. You're going to look at some stuff this morning, if I ever start pushing these buttons, and you're going to see some things that you're going to say, how, weren't there any poor folks? You know, didn't they have any poor, starving Armenians and Russians and Poles and Jews and all of them? Weren't they taking care of people and threw all their money into the art? What a waste! You know, you got to understand that the same concepts, the two-bit word for this, the milieu, the arena out of which all of this was built, out of which the artist made these things, was the same arena out of which the people identified with them. The artist wasn't putting anything over on the folk. The artist was one of the folks. And we don't think of that anymore like this. It's hard for us to get that into our noggins on account of, we know what artists are. They walk around in bare feet, and they live up in attics, and they eat dry bread and moldy cheese, and they ain't one of the folks. Artists are, you know, they're flying around, you know, looking down on us poor peasants, and they're saying, if you don't like what I'm doing, you're a schmuck. You know, you ain't got no class because I'm an artist and you're a peasant. Boy, the artist and the peasant, it was all the same thing. So you got to understand these things in the context of the times in which they were done. Gene, you give me a high sign. I'm not going to look at my... At the clock, so you let me
what
know.
What time do you want to have the high sign?
Well, I don't know, will a bell ring for coffee or
yeah,
something like that? Or, is that okay? Okay. Okay. Once again, back in the catacombs, the artists were the people who went down underground. And they were the Christians. And they went down. And they were like you and me. They were like... They were like kids drawing mustaches on subway posters. You know, you go into New York and you see all the graffiti scratched all over the thing. Well, it's a very interesting thing. If you look at graffiti in New York, in an age in which there's a tremendous amount of oppression, huh? And you look down in the subways or on the walls, look at the writings of people who are oppressed, who have their thumbs in the thumb screws, and the heel of whatever oppresses people, economics, politics, whatever, is on their necks. And they are writing. They are writing a sign on the wall. And you check all the... I've got a marvelous book of graffiti. And much of it is funny. Most of it is full of hope. Signs of hope. Charlie loves you, no matter what you say. You know, you see that on a big sign. It was written in about three feet high letters across a whole brick wall in New York. And that was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. I took a movie of it. I couldn't even get the whole thing in a picture. You know, I stepped back and the whole thing disappeared behind some other building. So I had to get kind of close to it, and I couldn't get the whole thing. And so I decided to get the movie camera and just go from one end to the other. Charlie loves you no matter what you say. I think that is just absolutely fantastic. These people are giving a sign of the hope that's in them, and it's the same thing that's in the catacombs. We don't look at graffiti nowadays, what's written on the bathroom walls, what's written on the subway walls, what's scrawled on anything you can get your hands. We don't look at that as necessarily an extension of art, of the art of our time. We look at it as individuals simply sometimes venting their spleen. Sometimes they just have to get it out. You know, every child is born with this necessity of somehow giving a visual demonstration of how it feels. Every one of us was born that way. So it's very natural. I mean, and of course, the things the kids wrote on until you told them it was naughty was the wall. They come at your walls. They lay their handprints, and they get fascinated by that. These are the handprints of the early Christians, and we don't look at them for stylistic content, for plastic juxtapositions of figure ground motifs. We look at them as Christian folks. Some of them couldn't draw worth a darn. Some of those people were absolutely hand-fisted klutzes. They just simply had to get down there and make a statement. And every single one of them that we got is a statement of hope. Of all of the thousands of statements that are down in the catacombs, they all say something neat about, I'm happy, I'm feeling good, I'm looking forward to the heavenly banquet, thank you, Jesus, here's a saint. Here, she was such a beautiful child, 11 years old, the day she went to the lions. Whew! You know, not one of them that was angry or uptight with God for putting them in this particular predicament. Some of them were prayers. In fact, they started developing a way of a set of symbols. That figure over there, which is pretty well drawn. Somebody that came down knew how to draw. This guy couldn't draw at all. That's ridiculous. Look at that. Brilliant. Crazy. Rooster up there is one of the funniest looking things I've ever seen. That guy could draw pretty good. And they developed, this was already established, a standing figure with hands out like that was an orant. An orant. And it's the sign, it's the way people pray. That was the posture of prayer. Folding hands, we were talking about that the other day. Folding hands didn't come until much later. Byzantium decided that they wanted to get all the people who were against the emperor together in one big place at the same time. And the emperor didn't want anybody carrying any weapons, so he had them all walking into the arena with their hands folded.
On their knees.
Yeah, to make sure that they weren't concealing any weapons or establishing a posture of offense. And so that's how we pray. You know, we're letting God know we don't have any weapons. It used to be out. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane praying to his Father. He couldn't even have been out like that, standing. He would have been flat on his face in the dirt with his hands straight forward. And but you try and convince people that Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane wasn't leaning up against a rock, and you're really in bad trouble.
Well, blue-eyed blonde.
Blue-eyed blonde, yes. The Scandinavian Jesus. But this figure is not just a standing praying figure. That's a soul. That is a soul. So already the early Christians were beginning to take motifs from their traditions, Greek, primarily Greek and Roman, but they were establishing some kind of spiritual content.
How do you know that it's soul?
Because they said it was. Yeah, because they said, it, in fact, it usually represented someone that had already been martyred. So they drew a picture of him, and it wasn't like a portrait, it was a type. So you'd have a woman representing a departed woman's saint, and it's the soul. And it's the soul praying for all of the people who are still there. Okay. Neat thing. The heavenly banquet. This isn't the picture of the Last Supper. It's evidently the Christians were not fed too well by their Roman captors, and so they constantly drew pictures down there of people looking forward to the heavenly banquet. And who are they going to meet in heaven? Irene, Calda, Agatha, Miskimi. Irene, bring me some hot water. Agatha, stir it up. They mixed the water, hot water, with wine. And that was a typical feast dish in the heavenly banquet. But who are Irene and Agatha? They're Roman goddesses. Like early Christians are going to go up to heaven and meet Roman goddesses, and the Roman goddesses are going to be their servants. That's heaven. So you design your artwork based on where you're at, on what you know. Here is a psalm, an illustration for a psalm from one of the most beautiful books ever executed. It's called the Paris Psalter. And there is David praying to the Lord God, and the Lord God is answering. You can see his hand coming out of the cloud. This is a psalm about nighttime. The goddess of night is right behind David, holding up her blanket over her head with all the stars on it.
So that was Bathsheba.
No. No, she couldn't keep her blanket up. So David is surrounded by all of these little symbols and signs of images that already existed outside of the Christian context. Oh, look at this. Look at this. Fantastic. Early Christian, a very important man, name was Junius Bassus. Already we know he was important because we know his name. Junius Bassus built the sarcophagus, and he hired some very, very excellent guys. He said, this is fine carving for the side of a sarcophagus. Christ on the throne of judgment. Moses and Elias on either side. And the throne of judgment, how does an early Christian get his newfound Lord up in the sky on the throne of judgment? If that early Christian is Roman, he puts him on a blanket held over the head of Zeus.
Oh, great.
That's Zeus. Christ on the throne of judgment, held up there by Zeus. What's an early Christian to do? Now, well, you're going to say, now, man, these poor people can't get their religion straight. It isn't a matter of getting your religion straight. It isn't even a matter of trying to identify where Christianity begins and secularism lets off or paganism lets off. There is a way of talking. Visual ways are ways of talking. And so when a guy imagines Christ on the throne of heaven at this particular time, he cannot help but identify that throne of heaven being supported by all the images that went on before his conversion. So, Christian art was Zeus, you know. That's why I say, let's not even talk about Christian art. Let's talk about art in a Christian context. And you take and put into it what you need, and that what you need depends on where you are at your particular time. This is that little souvenir I talked about yesterday, brought by the people when they went to visit Jerusalem. It was the early postcard, you know. Hi, Mom, I made it. We made it all the way to the Rotunda of the Anastasis, Mom. And when I see you, I'm going to bring you back a little souvenir. You can hang it around your neck. And here it is. A little, about the size of a silver dollar, a vial made out of pounded silver, and it contained oil. from the lamps that burn at the rotunda of the Anastasis. So, once again, iconography of place. Remember we were talking about that? Oil that burned there. And now you take this oil and you take it back with you. And on there, little images. Now the images over here were made by obviously a guy from a completely different setup background than here. You know who that figure is? The Christ figure? How do we make our Lord God if we're in Rome? Apollo. That's Apollo. That's exactly the same way they made Apollo. One of the last pictures I show you today. Remember this image. I'm going to show you what, the next time this figure comes around in history. And it's very interesting. But over here, look at the Christ figure. Obviously not made by a fellow from Greek and Roman origin, but one from the Middle East. Christ has almond eyes, a little pointy beard, a shaggy robe. He is a Syrian prophet. So, Christ images are made in the images of those people that made them. In fact, one of the popes that was against images made a big pronouncement. And he said, if horses and dogs could draw pictures of their Christ, Christ would look like a horse or a dog. He was right. He was absolutely right. The little building at the bottom there, that's the rotunda of the Anastasis. Whenever anybody ever saw a little picture like that, the thing they met, that went into their minds, just from the little scratchings of that kind of image, immediately, resurrection. Resurrection. As a result, what buildings were built in that little shape throughout Christendom as a result of images that were brought back on little vials like that? Baptistries. Baptistries all over the Christian world were built in the shape of the rotunda of the Anastasis.
Did that have just a domed roof?
Had a domed roof, and inside it had eight sides. Eight sides. If you go to your old baptism font, you'll probably find an eight-sided shape. And it means something. People get so excited, you know, when they finally find out it's not just an octagon, but it really means something. The number eight. The number seven is the complete number. Man is a seven number. He is body and soul. Soul, three is the spirit number. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So spiritual things come in threes. Earthly things come in fours. The four corners of the earth. The four basic elements. Yeah. So three and four together is the number of body and soul. It's also the number of completeness. 7 days in the week. 7 notes in the Gregorian scale. 7 vices. 7 virtues. And thus, 7 is the number of completeness, 8 is the number of beginning again. Ye must be born again. So baptismal fonts are 8-sided. Isn't that neat? Woo! So, the early Christians took their motifs from where they were. They did a lot of mosaic. They did a lot of stuff that was interior. These people were still hiding out. They had complexes that went back a couple generations. I mean, you knock on the door and you had to say something like, St. Paul sent me, and then you could walk in and be with the rest of the people. But they didn't advertise. You know, the early Christian basilicas didn't say, Sunday morning services, 9 o'clock, 10:30. We'll have a little coffee hour after the late service. Everybody welcome. No way. If you walk past an early Christian basilica, well, like we saw at San Apollinare last night, looks like a railroad station. But just like a railroad station. I mean, some of them look like barns, garages. Really nothing on the outside, that suggests that that's what was going on inside. But inside, the mystery of some of the stuff that went on inside was just fantastic. See, that's... What are you going to do, you know? You're going to say, stop the bus, I want to go in there, you know? Boy, do I want to see that place. What do you want to see that place for? It's a stupid place. You know, looks like a garage. You go in there and you find an old car and a bunch of rakes, you know, in there. No, you go in there and you find that. Every square inch of that place covered with mosaic. That's inside that little garage-type building called the Gala Placidia. Who is this fellow? Remember last night? That's Lorenzo. Lorenzo, who was barbecued. And there he is with the instrument of his martyrdom. Now that little garagey-looking building is in the backyard of that big garagey-looking building over there. That is San Vitale. We are in Ravenna. Nothing on the outside. In fact, that's a little miniature Hagia Sophia. Kind of like the dome on the top and, you know. That's the inside. I took a 6-credit course. It took 2 semesters. The whole course was a postgraduate course, and it was a postdoctoral course in the mosaics of this building. The one building. For a year, we talked about nothing but the mosaic cycles in this one building. And Ravenna, Ravenna, what is a Ravenna? I mean, when people go to Europe, they go to Venice. And from Venice, they go to Florence. You go right by this place. You drive right through it. And very few people stop. It is one of the most exciting art cities, Christian art, any old art you want, in the whole world. But you drive by it, you can't figure out, you know, you're looking for monuments, and the monuments are all undercover, because that's what the early Christians were. And the Byzantine, even after Christianity became officialized, the Byzantine monuments were very introverted. Everything on the inside, nothing on the outside, and they were all, you know, mosaic. All of this is little pieces of glass, a half inch by a half inch by a half inch. Little cubes of glass. The palette range in here is 8,000 colors. 8,000 different colors. And they're all in glass cubes. And they're all set in concrete. And there are square acres of it in this one little building. And it's a small building. It's just got a lot of nooks and crannies in it. See this little thing here? There's the altar. Over the altar, we're in Italy now, and the Christ that is on the throne over the altar is an Apollo figure again, and on either side, we've got these mosaics. They're life-size. That's the emperor, the Byzantine emperor, and this is that bear trainer lady. Theodore, every time I see her, I just gets me so excited to think there was a lady ruling an empire that used to be a prostitute and a bear trainer, and now she's the queen of the realm, you know. Not only was she a prostitute and a bear trainer, now she is not only the empress, but check that. She got a halo. And she's alive. She was living when this thing was made. Emperor's got a halo. He was alive. Now, wow, what does that mean? Well, I could spend the rest of I was thinking the rest of our period. I could spend the rest of the year in talking about now what happens to art in Byzantium. You see the retinue, the court of the emperor, You see the shield of the shield bearer. On it is a chrismon. It's a Cairo. It's the monogram of Christ. If you check the retinue, you will note that there are 12 people in the emperor's retinue. The emperor is an icon, an image of Christ. He is a walking two-legged image of Christ. And the emperor went about his daily procedures with his people emulating the Christ figure. He would wash feet. He would lay his hands on sick people. He had a throne that took off like a butterfly. It was a wild thing. He had a peacock throne. Peacock is a symbol of the... in fact, lots of people in the Mideast had peacock thrones. The sultans had peacock thrones.
Maharajas.
The emperor was the guy that started that, because the peacock was life hereafter. Peacock constantly renewed its feathers and was a symbol, kind of like the earliest form of the phoenix, the bird that rose from its own ashes. And the emperor's throne was shaped like a peacock, and you'd walk into the throne room of the emperor if he let you, and you went down on your, you crawled, and you never looked straight at the throne. You always looked down on the ground, and you crawled in there, and all of a sudden trumpets would blare, cannons would go off, and there was a tremendous whoosh, and that was the sign that you could get up. And when you got up, the emperor was up there in the sky. He was floating. His whole throne was hanging from the ceiling, and the emperor was looking down from his bird, from his peacock. Now that sounds absolutely outrageous, you know. Oh, how ridiculous can you get? But what he was doing was emulating the concept of Christ over and over and over again.
What's he carrying?
That is the ciborium. That is the bowl that the wafers are kept in, and she is carrying the chalice. And those were
they're
the
both
gifts.
In purple.
And they're both in purple.
Yeah.
And look at the bottom of her robe. The three wise men. The three wise men. So they are continually serving as examples and images of the Christ figure. It's real, and boy, you want to see some beautiful ladies. This is her lady-in-waiting, and that's her daughter. And the way those people are executed in these little cubes of glass is just gorgeous. Just look at the robe, all the detail going on in here. Fantastic.
Are they also 12 in that one?
I don't think.
I just wondered if they.
No, they're not. Gold. Gold. When you think of Byzantium, you think of just incredible wealth in gold. But it's not just the wealth, it's the mystery. Everything in Byzantium was like revelation. It was like epiphanos, they referred to it as in the Greek. Epiphanos. All the mysteries of Christ are revealed to us in this kind of spiritual revelation. And gold was the dematerializing element. Everything that took place in gold had a special content that was not pure worldly. And so all the stories of Christ took place against the background of gold. All the saints, the angels, the archangels. As a result, you know, and all these little cubes of glass with the gold leaf set in the glass were set into the concrete at different levels. This entire picture here, I took without a flash, using nothing but candlelight. This is also nothing but candlelight. You hold one candle, and it's reflected a couple billion times. Every cube bounces that light at a different angle. So you got all these, you know, it's a million candle power.
You know, it's just going like crazy, shimmering. And you walk into these buildings, and it's just like you've left the world. You've really left the world.
Constantine and Justinian. This is a little spot in the narthex of the Hagia Sophia. The mosaic there. Obviously, we have gotten to an advanced theology of Mary now, and Mariolatry is, that's not a good word. They revered Mary tremendously as the Mother of God. And so here is Constantine presenting the city of Constantinople to Mary. And here is Justinian presenting the Hagia Sophia, the building in which this is located, to Mary. Everything here, all the gifts, presented to Mary. And she sits on the throne of heaven, and she is surrounded by the arena of gold. The dome, one of the domes, with all of the mosaic and the painting and Mary in the center. The image of Christ as Pantocrator, as judge, as giver of the law, is very important. In fact, Justinian wrote a whole set of laws for the governing of the empire, which are still used today. They are referred to in almost all the law schools. And this was the first one. So the idea of the law was very important. And the judge image winds up being very severe. Byzantium actually, as a legal state, meted out very, very harsh punishment to people that broke the law. This is all mosaic. Yeah? We're moving around. This now, the Hagia Sophia is in Istanbul. Yeah, that's why I'm kind of referring to some of the things we went through last night, and so the buildings that we were referring to that we talked about last night. The Byzantine Empire had some of its most important territory in Greece. Greece still holds on to an awful lot of Byzantine ritual. And these places, this is Hosius Lucas, which is a little monastic community north and west of Athens. And these are just examples of the techniques and styles that were used in Byzantium. And these are icon. Now, icon means image. So hard to explain. It's so hard to really believe, because it's an Eastern concept. This is not a picture of Christ. This is Christ. It is Christ. Now, how do you get that coming just off of a little cube set in concrete? How can you say that that is? But first of all, I don't say it. The Byzantine community says it. And what the Byzantine community says is what it is. You know. I mean, it would be very much like walking in to our church service, like we're going to have Sunday night, when Bill, or whoever is distributing, says, "Take, eat. This is my body. Take, drink. This is my blood." And you look at that little thing and you say, "Wait a minute now. I know that this bread was baked in the kitchen just yesterday. And this bottle, I saw the bottle back in the sacristy and it said Manischewitz on it. Now that is not the blood. Come on." The community says it is, and the community is affirming what Christ says it is. And we have a sacrament. We have a sacrament because of community and Christ in the center of that community. Same thing.
same thing. The painting, the executing of these things, was a sacramental ritual that could only be done by the priests. And there was a specific way in which it had to be done. And if you look at these things done around 600-700, if you look at the images that were done in 1900, after, you know, all those years, 1200 years of doing all this stuff, they're still the same. Still the same. No change. Ritual. Orthodoxy. All based about the sacrament. And you can say, well, that's not the Jesus Christ I know, and you're right. You're right. But that does not remove the fact that for the worshiping community at that particular time, that was not a picture. That was Christ. Even when people ran into hideouts, this is in the Valley of the Gerain in central Turkey, and the people built during the iconoclastic controversy, when some people said, those aren't, we've got to get rid of images. And the priest said, no, the images are an assist to our understanding of the life of Christ in us. The power at that time shifted towards the iconoclast, and the priests and the monks and everything were getting killed, and they ran away, and that's the monastic system starting, you know. They ran into this one valley and started digging cathedrals out of living rock, and they paint on them. I can't get over the similarity between some of the paintings that they did and the art of the Southwest Indian. And it just kind of spooks me to see that. The images vary slightly, but you can see we are talking about a model that remains very consistent. This is in Daphne, a suburb of Athens, and that was done around 700. Just as in Meteora, and that was done around 1400. And it remains very, very constant. This is, in fact, remember I showed you those little monasteries sitting on top of the rock? And you got to lower and raise the people up in a basket over the side. That's what they were doing on the inside of those things, preserving the images. And it wasn't idolatry. It was not idolatry. When this sort of thing wound up over in the West, it became idolatry because the West didn't understand the sacramental nature of the making of these things. And the people in the East were not revering the image in the same way that they were revering the Christ that the image was of. But in the West, they started doing it a little differently, and they started paying homage to a particular, you know, to a particular statue, and thank you, Mary, for favors granted, and they were really referring to the Black Madonna of the Tepes, you know, or something of that sort. And, terrible, very definitely idolatry. But in the East, they thought, how you did it, your story of the little four-year-old girl, you and the four Waldson thing, you know, and she was, and she says, did you miss me, Jesus? You know, she wasn't talking to a hunk of marble or plastic or wood or whatever that was, you know. That wood or that poor Waldson thing, and for some of us it can be some really pretty silly stuff. It can be, you know, I mean, if you ask me, Solomon's Head of Christ, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. There's a bearded lady. Who is? Who is Sissy Pants? You never expect to go downtown and see Jesus walking around looking like that. You know? No way! That's why I think that's why people like it so much. It doesn't confront you. You know, you can put this big space between you and whatever that ectoplasm is floating around on there with the little neon bulb behind its head. You know? So you don't have to confront it. But on all
you know, I'm mocking out because an awful lot of people, an awful lot of people use that as a resource for getting them directly to the God experience. And it works. The only problem is the next step after that is to say, that's my Jesus. That isn't your Jesus. Jesus is inside, you know, he's with you, you know? And that four-year-old girl, that wasn't her Jesus. That was like a, that was like the vehicle through which she understood how much Jesus was in her. So artwork can operate that way, but it's very tricky, the difference between using and abusing, really, you know. And the tendency, I think, for the Protestant movement is to be iconoclastic, to have no image at all. And that's why that Solomon Head of Christ is so right for the for the Protestant. That is a Protestant image, because it is no image. This is not a believable thing.
This guy confronts you.
Oh, man. He confronts you with the law. That is Pantocrator judge. Yeah. See what they do with their images.
Incredible.
What do you think of the Hook's portrait?
Hook? I think of Hook's portrait as being Christ, our non-directive counselor. I mean, when you go to Hook's Christ and you say, God, I've got a problem, Hook's Christ says, I understand you've got a problem. And when you ask, you say, I'm having trouble confronting myself. I don't think I have any value or any worth. Hook's Jesus says, I understand you don't feel that you have any worth. Is that right?
I know that the pastor, you said, a lot of the young people come in and ask for that messed up crap.
Yeah.
They don't know who's in it or what, but they crap.
Yeah.
Messed up crap.
Yeah. No, it's a Jesus with rumpled hair and who looks at least like he gets around on the level of people. But for me, it's still totally human. Totally human. I somehow need to have a Christ who is totally human and totally God, totally divine. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible. In fact, you know, Hook's Christ is only Christ because Hook said it's Christ. And if somebody, if Hook decided to one day say, ha ha, I fooled you all, actually that's a painting of my cousin who is a hippie, then we're going to have to say, ha ha, you win, I lose, that's Hook's cousin and he's a hippie. What can you say? He's got you. We all got you. I mean, you know, the artist game is really a, it's kind of frightening. But what can you say about that? There's no way that I'm going to come up to this image and say, if the artist decides to tell me that that's the girl down the street, I'm going to have to believe it. I don't care what the artist says about it. That is not the girl down the street. That is Mary. And it isn't Mary meek and mild, because I don't think she gives a hoot about the kid in her bosom. The kid is looking straight out, and Mary is looking straight out, and she is the mother of God. Boom. And she is right in league with the lawgiver. Law is coming from Jesus and from Mary and from the Father and the Spirit all together, and it's kind of this straightforward. That is not one of your typical Old Testament Syrian prophets walking around in the wilderness. That thing has elevated itself to contain both human and divine content. And I think our, you know, we lost that. We lost it long before Hook or me. I do Jesus's all the time, and every one of them I just get, oh, that's not it.
that's not it. That's not what I want.
You know,
we lost it in the Renaissance. The Renaissance wound up giving us Jesuses that were nothing more than the guy down the street.
Where are these looking?
This one is in... No, they're both in the same building. St. Mark's in Venice.
Oh, really?
This is the center panel of the Palla di Oro, the veil of gold, which is over the high altar, and this is at the baptistry.
Do they keep a cordon of pulling ceramics?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. Italy is probably the rottenest place in the world for protecting its heritage that you ever saw in your life. Well, they're ripping stuff off right and left over there. But look at that. No change. That was done in the early part of this century. 1400 years later than the icon. Flat, the gold, the epiphanous motif, the same kind of image. Well, shoot, this is fun and exciting. I just kind of like to keep going. In the age that followed, we talked last night, the monument then became the book, because everybody was kind of moving, shifting around. The monastery was holding things together, and they built the monasteries in strange hideout places. One of them was Lindisfarne. Lindisfarne was an island off the coast of Ireland. And a couple other hideout places, and this is Spain. Remember I told you when Islam came up and they met the Spanish Christians and they got together and we had Islamic Christians? What were they supposed to paint like? Because images were out as far as Islam. You cannot make an image, period. That's why they plastered over the Hagia Sophia. You can't go into a building that's got images and call it religious. They were very Hebraic in that sense. So the Islams became Christian and they started doing Christian pictures, Christian images, and they are the most delightful thing. This style, this combination of Islamic and Spanish Christian is called Mozarabic. And the Mozarabic paintings look just like Islamic carpets, but with Christian subject matter. Look at the feet. Oh, you love those feet. All pretty. I think if you count, you'll find you've got 1 foot too many. Look at the eyes. It's pattern. These guys are pattern people. They're carpet weavers. So if you look at all the eyes, exactly the same thing. They're all looking over here somewhere. I don't know. He's up here, you guys. You know, and the wings of the ape. Look at the hand. The hand of Christ is like a meat hook. It goes way out there like a baseball mitt. They are not concerned about duplicating visual reality. These guys are confronting this kind of, gee, dare I make an image? This took a tremendous amount of risk on these guys' part. These were confirmed Islamic, no image guys, and their new faith. Their whole new conversion said, I've got to do it. I just got to do it, but I don't have all that background. You know, I don't have that training, and I'm still kind of afraid that I'm going to have to celebrate it in the way I know how to celebrate it, and that's with pattern and that saffron yellow. Oh, wow, what a yellow. It's a kind of like mustard gas coming at you, you know, plain and red and blue. It's just primary, basic. You know, it kind of hits you, but it's flat and it's a page, and it's beautiful. Is that your typical slavering, nomadic, Viking-type Charlton Heston, Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis, greasy, you know, where they grab a hunk of raw meat on a bone and they go... And then they wipe their greasy mouths off on their sleeves and they grab for the nearest long blonde-haired wench they can find and cart her off upstairs, and that was the Dark Ages. Well, the Dark Ages are getting smaller and smaller the more we find out about them. Used to be the Dark Ages covered from around 600
to 1400. Now the Dark Ages cover around 800 to 1000. What's happening is that they're getting brighter. And actually, we were in the dark. It was us that was in the dark. They were doing some incredible stuff. But look at that was a little piece that hung from the crown of one of the queens of these nomadic tribes. Just the most exquisite jewelry work you could possibly imagine. They had to keep it portable. They weren't building great monuments, but they did bring the book, which is probably one of the greatest monuments of all. And these little guys in their monasteries were executing in their little details and little filigrees very much the way their forebearers were executing bridle bits and saddles and harnesses and things of that sort. They had a way. Look at the interlace on here. Gorgeous. This is an Irish book cover from around the year 600. A book cover carved in leather. A solid leather. And the interlace on here would just drive you crazy to figure it out. It is just so beautiful.
What was that on the right?
That's from the Book of Darrow, and that's all also Anglo-Irish, and it is the portrait of Saint
Matthew.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. But these guys are considering things flat. Notice here, Byzantine influence creeping into manuscript illumination. All the art that came over from these guys generally moved from east to west. That's the general migration pattern. They came down from the north and from the east and moved over to the west. And they brought with them a lot of the Eastern heritage. If you remember Mary sitting on the throne with Constantine and Justinian on either side, if you would have looked at the little seat that she was sitting on, you would have seen that the front of it was smaller than the back of it. We know when we draw that everything has to come to a point. You know, that's called perspective. Well, don't tell that to a guy from the Orient. He will say you are wrong, and you are. You are. The only way you can look at that when it comes to a point like that is from one little spot, you know. And what you are drawing is what you see. It's not what you know. For the Orient, everything opens up. And so,
who's hiding behind the drape?
That is the muse.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's beautiful. That is Matthew's muse. Matthew is being dictated to by himself, filled with the Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we know it's Matthew because of the winged man, not an angel. Not an angel. Matthew's symbol is not an angel. It's a winged man. And there's a big difference there. Matthew, I'm doing the genealogy of Christ thing now and in my paintings. And Matthew is very much talking about God, you know, flesh and blood down here in the earth. But still, he soars, the two natures of the God-man relationship. And that little bench opens up, you know, it's going to get bigger and bigger as it grows back. Yeah. Little Byzantine stuff. This is Irish. This is from the Book of Kells. I know one fellow that tried to dissect this. He wrote a doctoral dissertation on this one page. It's 700 pages long and about that thick. It's full of plastic overlays. And he just tried to unravel all of the knots inside of here. He is now being taken care of by the state of Indiana in an institution. It took him something like 4 years. He never completed it. They gave him his doctoral degree. Can you imagine that? Trying to uncoil the coils. Now, you would think uncoiling that thing would be difficult, but can you imagine putting it together in the first place? These little monks in the monasteries doing all this incredible
incredible stuff, trying to analyze just the celebration of coiled interlacing and making, and that's just the first letter. That's not even a word. That's not even a page. That's not even a gospel. It's the first letter of the book of Luke. Oh my gosh, these guys, a monument. You could carry it under your arm, but anybody that says that is not a monument doesn't know the meaning of the word. Just portable, that's all. And the book, it takes all these different forms. This is Merovingian. This, once again, is Anglo-Irish. Merovingians were French. This is the this is from the family out of which Charlemagne came. That's also Merovingian. Animals, all over their manuscripts. They let little dogs with their teeth, with their tongues sticking out, and their feet out, and their paws like that. And you got a letter E, you know, like that, letter E. And they'd make them out of animals because the animal life, the vegetation, the growing things, were so much a part of these people's
lives. That's a bird with a human face.
Not this one.
Isn't that a human face?
No.
It looks like it to me.
Well, maybe it could be. I got a beak here and an eye there. It's a profile.
Oh. Stand over this way, you got a face. At an angle from this side, there's a face right here.
Uh-huh.
Two eyes,
oh, yeah,
nose and the mouth, and
sure,
the chin, and the hair is flopping over that one.
Ain't no hair, that's a beak.
Okay. So, you know, you got to contend with your audience,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah, you betcha. Charlemagne tied all of Europe together, gave them a uniform kind of writing called uncial, got a guy from England to be in charge of the designing of script. Uncial meaning based on the measurement of your thumb. It's kind of neat. Uncial script, and Charlemagne had a special scriptorium that designed the script, and a special artist's territory in which they designed the books and illustrated the books, and that was under the direction of a guy named Ebo, Bishop Ebo. And out of that came this kind of style, which is very expressionistic and alive and really charged up. And you can see it, you can almost sense here the activity of the court of Charlemagne, where everything is just really going and hopping, almost maybe humanistic. Look at, that's a real man up there, and yet he's being inspired by the Holy Spirit, and it's kind of making him wiggle, you know? Later on, when everything kind of fell apart in the Carolingian Empire, and it became Ottonian, and then in the year 1000, things once again became rather established, stable, orderly, and not quite so free.
I love that. That book, to me, it's just perpendicular.
Straight up, yeah. That's the Byzantine again. Yeah.
No perspective on that.
Well, I know. We want to see the book. We want to see that it's a book. How can you... The Egyptians were great at this.
Yeah.
Fantastic at this. You
and
know,
it went one way and bodies.
That's absolutely right. How can you tell when a face is a face? You know? How do you know that it's a chest? If people are walking sideways, you can't tell that's a chest. In fact, it isn't a chest. It's the edge of your arm. So turn it around, you know. So we got a chest from the front, and a face from the side, and feet from the legs from the front, and feet from the side. What's the front of a foot look like? Just five little bones. You know, that's not a foot. We know what a foot is. Remember all those guys with their feet all lined up? You know? All this interweaving of style and tradition, but also, you don't say, well, he did that because he didn't know how to draw. You know. Man, no, they did that because they were trying to say a specific thing, and this was the way they said it. And now we come to the Romanesque. The Romanesque we talked about was that law
and they were saved from the law, but they were still under it. You always walked into a Romanesque church under a tympanum that showed God on the throne of judgment. So law was very important. This was the magician that fell when he tried to imitate Christ, you know, from the book of Acts. They were still experimenting with how to roof the inside of a church. That's a barrel vault, and they painted some frescoes up there. That's the tympanum, the archway over the door, and there's the God on the throne of judgment, and the damned and the saved. But at the same time, you ran across some of the most, this is this inventive, delightful period. There are the three wise men all in bed together. These, by the way, are 75 feet up in the air on top of columns. You can't see them like this. You know, you got to hang by your thumbs in order to get a picture like this. The angel comes to the three wise men. He touches the one wise man who luckily has his arm outside the blanket and hits him on the little finger. And you just follow that line up here, up his arm. He got his eye open. All the other guys are still sleeping, but the angel has touched the finger of one guy and he's got his eye open.
But typically, there's no bodies under that blanket.
Oh, no. They all come together in one pair of feet. Well, yeah. The flight into Egypt. I got to do that today. And I got to do the flight into Egypt. Something like that. That's where I am in the book of Matthew. Have you ever seen a flight into Egypt where the donkey had wheels? Isn't that marvelous? God is making the rough places plain and giving that donkey some wheels. He can roll along on the way. That is just absolutely delightful. These are all done by one guy, the sculptor of Altoun, a guy by the name of Gisselbertus, one of the first men of the Middle Ages whose name we know. And look at this Eve. That Eve is just spectacular, not just because of the classical design. Classical, when we say that, we mean a point at which abstraction and idealism meet so that neither one dominates. Look at that figure. Perfectly believable, realistic figure. Look at that. That's not realistic. That is not believable. That is a shape. That is a type of plant which is superimposed. Look at this. Her whole body conforms to this abstract twining. So we've got this believability and this abstraction operating so close together that the whole thing is a believability, but it is more than just simply visual reality. But look at her. Look at, she is not just a type. She is a person. She is reaching behind her for the apple, and she knows already that she has done wrong. She's crying in the act of, she hasn't taken a bite yet. And the whole story is over. It's incredible. Look at her here. Yeah. Look at that. Two views of the same woman, and she is two women. She is seductress over here. She is really pondering her whole fate over here. It's just incredible. Whacked out of a piece of limestone, and we got a person up there, and that's really the introduction to the Gothic. And where Christ in the Gothic was still Pantocrator on the throne of judgment, now comes the age of piety, and Christ comes down on the trumo, on this post, and becomes le bon Dieu, the good God. Not just the God of judgment that we come under as we go into the church, but the one whose foot we pat as we walk in and get a blessing with direct physical contact.
Like the Hebrew touching the stone door.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. It comes from that tradition. And Mary becomes on the verge of total humanness. There's still some delight. Oh, look at the souls in Abram's bosom.
Isn't that marvelous? I just love that. Little head sticking out of a blanket, you know.
They got no bodies either. They couldn't all fit in there. You know, Abraham is just really tremendous, you know, and he's holding up his skirt. He's got all those souls right inside there. Really neat.
And in early Gothic, we've got still an awful lot of that Byzantine full front kind of stuff happening.
Is that brown?
That's wood. These are wood. These are both wood. So early Gothic, late Gothic. Look at the difference. One gets really severe and frontal. The other one is swinging and gentle. And the baby has come up the side of Mary, is not in her lap, up head level. And looking at her, they are having the little feeling here. Mary, pay attention to me, Mary. Look over this way. This guy is a 40-year-old midget sitting on Mary's lap. Not this one. And the end of the Gothic is the whole death motif. Death and dying. Someone said the Reformation really was kind of like a thing that came into the middle of the church. The church was sentenced to death by itself primarily, and it was in prison in its cell, awaiting execution the next morning when the Reformation came in and stabbed it in the back.
Mercy killing.
Kind of the coup de grace, you know, it was going to happen, and you can see it on the face of the church. The church was in the throes of not realizing anymore what its potential was. If you want to mark where the church lost its power as a real agency of peoples, just check from village to village the date at which the cathedral was completed and dedicated. When the cathedrals were done, the church was done. In other words, the doing was the being. Really interesting. Very, very interesting. The doing, the making, was the being. Well, we sure didn't get as far as I wanted to get, but I hope it gives you an idea of the range and the scope and the reason for being of a lot of the church's art. And we'll continue this evening with where we are now with our architecture, and tomorrow morning where we are with our art today. Thank you so much.
Now you're talking about, you know, the Eastern Dome. Is that what the mosque is on the top of, like, in the east of the church? Or, you know, like, where it comes to the point?
The Tweedledome?
Yeah.
No, that's a particular type, which is pretty much Russian, and which was adopted by the Bavarian people for some reason. There must have been a lot of Russian influence in Bavaria, but it wasn't. That isn't really a typical. The dome of the